I don't even believe God doesn't exist, if you see what I mean. Of course, this is a matter of concern to my wife, too. Partly for my sake, partly for the boys. I lied to her about it for a little while. When I told her the truth, I believe she thought she could rescue me. As I said, when she first knew me, she took me for a man of the cloth. Many people make that mistake. He laughed. I generally correct them. I did her. Now the fact is, I don't know how old Boughton would take all this. It surprised me to realize that. I think it is an issue we never discussed in all our years of discussing everything. It just didn't come up. I said, I take it you've talked to Glory. No, I can't do that. She'd just break her heart over it. She can tell there's something on my mind. She probably thinks I'm in trouble. I believe my father thinks so, too.
I believe he does.
He nodded. He was crying yesterday. He looked at me. I have disappointed him again. And then he said, controlling his voice, I haven't had any word from my wife since I left St. Louis. I have been waiting to hear from her. I have written to her a number of times. What is the proverb? Hope deferred maketh the heart sick. He smiled. I have even found myself turning to liquor for solace.
I said, So I understand.
And he laughed. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto the bitter in soul. Isn't that right? Word for word. He said, The first thing she ever said to me was, Thank you, Reverend. She was walking home in a rainstorm with an armful of books and papers. She was a teacher, and some of the papers fell onto the pavement and the wind was scattering them, so I helped her gather them up. And then I walked her to her door, since I had an umbrella. I didn't think about what I was doing, particularly, my impeccable manners.
You were well brought up.
I was indeed, he said. Her father told me that if I were a gentleman, I'd have left her alone. I understand why he feels that way. She had a good life, and I am not a gentleman. He wouldn't let me object to that. I know what that word means, Reverend, though I can now say that the influence of my wife worked a change in me for the better, at least temporarily. Then he said, I don't want to tire you with this. I know I've interrupted you. I'll tell you why I have kept trying to talk to you. I told him he was welcome to take all the time he wanted. He said, That's very kind. And then he just sat there for a little while. If we could find a way to live, he said, I think she would marry me. That would answer her family's most serious objections, I believe. They say I can't provide a decent life for my family. And that has, in fact, been the case to this point. He cleared his throat. If you can really spare me the time, I will explain. Thank you. You see, I met Della during a fairly low point in my life. I won't go into that. Della was very nice to me, very pleasant. So I found myself now and then walking down that street at that hour, and sometimes I saw her and we spoke. I swear I had no intentions at all, honorable or otherwise. It was just pleasant to see her face. He laughed. She would always say, Good afternoon, Reverend. I was not at that time accustomed to being treated like a respectable man. I must say I enjoyed it. It got so that I would walk along her street with no thought of seeing her, just because there was a kind of comfort in being reminded of her. And then one evening I did meet her, and we spoke a little, and she asked me in for tea. She shared rooms with another woman who taught at the colored school. It was pleasant. We had our tea together, the three of us. I told her then I was not a minister. So she knew that. I believe she invited me in the first place because she was under that impression, but I was honest with her about that. It didn't seem to matter too much. I don't know just how it happened. I stopped by to lend her a book I had bought in order to lend it to her, as if from my library. I even dog-eared a few pages, and she invited me to come for Thanksgiving dinner. She knew I wasn't on excellent terms with my family,
and she said she couldn't have me spending the holiday by myself. I said I was uncomfortable with strangers, and she promised me it would be all right. Still, I had a couple of drinks before I came, and I was later than I had intended. I thought I would walk in on a gathering of some kind, but she was there all by herself, looking terribly unhappy. I apologized as well as I could and offered to go away, but she said, "You just sit down." So we sat there eating, neither one of us saying anything. I told her that dinner was delicious, and she said, "It probably was once." Then she said, "2 hours late, liquor on your breath," speaking to me as if I were, well, what I was, and it came over me that I had no business there. I was no one she could respect, and the grief I felt was amazing to me. I stood up to thank her and excuse myself, and then I left. But when I had walked a few blocks, I realized she was following along behind me. She came up beside me, and she said, "I just wanted to tell you not to feel so bad." And I said, "Now I will have to walk you back to your door." And she laughed and said, "Of course you will." So I did. And then the other woman came home, Lorraine, the one who shared her rooms. There was a dinner at the church, but Della had made some excuse about not feeling well and having to stay home. I should have been long gone by then, but there we were, eating our pumpkin pie. What could have been more compromising? He laughed. It was all so respectable. But word got to Tennessee somehow, and her sister came to visit, with the clear intention of scaring me off. I'd come in the evenings with a book of poetry, and we'd read to each other while her sisters sat there glaring at me. It was ridiculous. It was wonderful. But when the school year ended, her brothers came and took her back to Tennessee. She left a note for me with Lorraine saying goodbye. I knew her father couldn't be hard to find since he was a minister, so I went there, to Memphis, and I found his church, a very large African Methodist Episcopal church, and the next morning, being Sunday, I went to hear him preach, knowing Della would be there, of course. And I hoped to speak to him. I thought it might recommend me to him if I could manage to seem forthright and manly, you know. I got my shoes shined and my hair trimmed. The church was full, and I sat near the back. But I was the only white man there, and people noticed me. Della's sister was in the choir, so of course she saw me, and I could tell her father suspected who I was by the way he watched me. He preached about those who come among you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. He also spoke about whited tombs, which inwardly are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Looking at me the whole time, of course. But I still made myself speak to him at the door. I said, "I only want to assure you that my friendship with your daughter has been entirely honorable." And he said, "If you were an honorable man, you would leave her alone." I said, "Yes, I will do that." Which was a lie, of course. I did intend to stop seeing her, but it was an intention I had formed in his church that morning. I thought that Della's standing with her family might be helped if I impressed him as a plausibly decent man, and my only chance of doing that was by going away. And I could see what a very good life she had. I'm not sure what my intentions had been in going there. Certainly I never thought I would leave without even saying one word to her, but I did. I left for St. Louis that same evening. I'm not sure he was impressed by my gallantry, but I do know it impressed Della. Then the fall came, and I happened to be walking down her street, as I happened to do every week or so, and there she was. I tipped my hat, and she burst into tears, and from that moment we have considered ourselves man and wife. Word got back to Tennessee, and she was more or less disowned. And then she got pregnant, and the school dismissed her. I was selling shoes at the time. There's very little money in it, but you don't get arrested for it either. So her mother came a few weeks before the baby was due and found us in a state of something like destitution, living in a residential hotel in an unpleasant part of town. It was humiliating. But of course we couldn't find respectable accommodations, and the hotel clerk where we got a room charged me a good deal extra for turning a blind eye, or words to that effect.
He had a phrase for the law we were breaking. Pernicious cohabitation, lascivious cohabitation? Lewd. For some reason, I always forget that word. You can't imagine how many ways they make things difficult. Then her father came, and her brothers, and the five of us had an earnest talk about Della's well-being, which began with her father saying, "You should be very glad that I am a Christian man." He is an imposing figure, and he persuaded me that I should tell Della to go home where she could be cared for. I did that, and she went away with him. Ah, the desolation, the relief. I was so scared by the thought of that baby. I knew in my miserable heart that something would go wrong and I would be to blame for it. I tried to hide my relief from her, but she could see it, and she was hurt by it. I knew she was. I told her I would come to Memphis as soon as I had saved up the money. It took me weeks because I had some debts and the fellows found me. I expected they would, and that was another reason I was glad to let her go. But of course I couldn't explain that to her. Finally, I wrote to my father and told him I needed money. He hadn't heard from me in a year at least, and he sent me 3 times as much as I asked for. And there was a note telling me that you were getting married. During those weeks, there was a revival, a tent meeting down by the river. I used to walk over there every night because there were crowds and noise and there wasn't much alcohol. One night, a man standing just beside me, as close to me as you are, went down as if he'd been shot. When he came up again, he threw his arms around me and said, "My burdens are gone from me. I have become as a little child." I thought, if I'd been standing 2 feet to the left, that might have been me. I'm joking, of course, more or less. But it's a fact that if I could have traded places with him, my whole life would be different. In the sense that I might have been able to look Della's father in the eye, maybe even my father. That I would no longer be regarded as quite such a threat to the soul of my child. That man was standing there with sawdust in his beard saying, "I was the worst of sinners." And he looked as if that might well be true. And there he was weeping with repentance and relief, while I stood watching with my hands in my pockets, feeling nothing but anxiety and shame. And a certain amusement, if you will forgive me. But the next day my father's letter came, and I got a decent coat and a bus ticket, and I was all right then. When I got to Memphis, the baby had just been born the day before, and the house was full of aunts and women from the church coming and going. They let me come in and sit in the corner. I don't think anyone knew what to do with me till her father came home, so they just went on with their business. If the day had been warmer, I think I'd have been sitting on the stoop. One woman said to me, "They're both just fine. They're sleeping." And she brought me a newspaper, which was kind of her. It eased my embarrassment to have something to look at. When her father finally did come home, the room emptied and the house became completely still. I stood up, but he didn't offer to shake hands. The first words he said to me were, "I understand you are not a veteran." Ah, I told him some lie about my heart, and then I regretted it instantly because I felt I had made myself sound feeble. But I needn't have worried about that because I could tell he didn't believe a word. As I recall, Deuteronomy says cowardice forbids one from going to the army. What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brother's heart melt as his heart. So I had scriptural warrant, though I chose not to mention it. He said, "I understand you are descended from John Ames of Kansas." Of course, anyone else would have put that right, but I thought there might be some advantage in letting him believe it. He was referring to your grandfather, of course. It was the first slightly positive thing he had ever said to me. He said he knew people whose families came north from Missouri before the war, and apparently they told some remarkable stories about him, about raids and ambushes. I told him I had heard stories about the old man while I was growing up, which is true. They were mainly stories about him running off with the laundry, but I didn't tell him that.
I remember my father said once, when he was a boy, the old man came to our church and sat in the back, and when the collection plate came to him, he just emptied it into his hat. It's a fact that my grandfather always did suspect the Presbyterians of hoarding, so that's not at all unlikely, and he did make a world of use of that hat. He said, "We had a few minutes of actual conversation, but I had to be cautious. I didn't know enough about the old times to risk telling lies, so I said my family had turned pacifist after the war and didn't encourage discussion of it. That's correct, I believe." "Absolutely." He knew my full name because it is what Della wanted to call the baby. I was so relieved when I heard that. Her father said, "She's been waiting for you." And I just sat there beside her bed all that afternoon, talking a little when she felt like it, looking at the baby now and then. The women would take him away if he cried. They brought in some supper. I thought maybe things were improving, but they were all just being Christian. In the evening, her father told me it would be best if I went away. He said, "This time I make no appeal to your honor." I suppose he had the right to say that. They were looking after her, and I didn't see how I could. So my thought was to go back to St. Louis and find a decent job and save up some money and try to figure something out. Because she talked to me about bringing the baby home, and she meant St. Louis. I left what I could of my father's money with her, and 3 months later she came with her sister and the baby to the old place, Lorraine's place, where she lived when I met her. I had a new room at the time, very clean and cheap, and also very respectable. Which is to say, I'd have been out on the street if I'd brought home a colored wife and child. I couldn't afford the old squalor if I was to save anything at all. As it is, I've never repaid my father, not a dime. So over all these years, we've been back and forth, with her going to Memphis when things were too difficult, for the boy's sake. He is a wonderful boy. I believe he has never really lacked anything. He has uncles and cousins, and his grandfather dotes on him. Della's father. My son's name is Robert Boughton Miles. He is very good to me, very respectful and polite, not as much at ease with me as your boy is. I managed, finally, about 2 years ago, to get a job that paid a little money. I made a down payment on a house in a mixed neighborhood, and Robert and Della came. It isn't much of a house, but I did some painting and found some rugs and chairs. And we had almost 8 months there. But then we got careless and went to the park together, and my boss happened to be there with his family. And the next day he called me into his office and told me he had his good name to consider. I hit him, which was very stupid of me. I hit him twice. He fell against his desk and cracked a rib. I thought I had talked him out of going to the law. I promised to pay his doctor bills and something for his inconvenience. But that evening, the police came to speak with us, to mention that law about cohabitating. It was humiliating, but I kept my head. I think it becomes a husband and father to stay out of jail when possible. I arranged to put my family on the bus to Memphis, rented the house, gave the dog to a neighbor. And when I had sorted that out as well as I could, I came here, thinking I might find some way to live with my family here. I mean, my wife and son. I have even thought it might be a pleasure to introduce Robert to my father. I would like him to know that I finally have something I can be proud of. He's a beautiful child, very bright. And believe me, he's being brought up in the church. He wants to be a preacher. But now I see how feeble my father is, and I don't want to kill him. I really don't. I have enough on my shoulders as it is. He said, "You will not tell me this is divine retribution." "Furthest thing from my mind." I was pretty sure I could trust you not to do that. I said, "Thank you." He drew a long breath. He said, "You know my father so well." "But I can't give you any assurances about this, one way or the other. I'd hate to be wrong. You'll have to let me reflect on it." Then he said, "If it were you and not my father..." Now, I could see his point in putting that question, since Boughton and I are, in general, very much of one mind. But it was not so simple a question as he might have thought, and I paused over it. He watched me for a minute, and then he smiled and said, "You have made a somewhat unconventional marriage yourself. You know a little bit about being the object of scandal, unequally yoked, and so on. Of course, Della is an educated woman." Those were his very words. Now that was just like him, that meanness. His remark was not even entirely to the point. And I never felt there was anything the least bit scandalous about my marriage. In her own way, your mother is a woman of great refinement. If a few people did make remarks, I just forgave them so fast it was as if I never heard them, because it was wrong of them to judge, and I knew it, and they should have known it. But then that look of utter weariness came over him, and he covered his face with his hands, and I could only forgive him. My thought when I hesitated was that since I was so long in the habit of seeing meanness at the root of everything he did, I might well have doubted his motives in involving himself with this woman he did not marry and bringing me this child. I'd have been wrong, I believe, but his question was not how I should react, but how I would be liable to react. With Boughton, this could be completely different, since he thought so much better of Jack, or so I had always believed. I said, "I would love to know the child, especially if you explained everything to me the way you just did." And then I said, "He certainly took to that other child." Young Boughton gave me such a look as I have never seen in my life before. He went stark white, then he smiled and said, "Children's children are the crown of old men." I said, "You have to forgive me for that. That was such a foolish thing to say. I'm tired. I'm old." "Yes," he said, and his voice was very controlled. "And I have taken far too much of your time. Thank you. I know I can trust your pastoral discretion." I said, "We can't let the conversation end here." But I was just so weary and downhearted, it was all I could do to get up from my chair. He stopped by the door, and I went over to him, and I put my arms around him. For a moment, he actually let his head rest on my shoulder. "I am tired," he said. I could just feel the loneliness in him. Here I was supposed to be a second father to him. I wanted to say something to him to that effect, but it seemed complicated, and I was too tired to think through the possible implications. It might sound as if I were trying to establish some sort of equivalency between his failings and mine, when, in fact, I would have meant he was a better man than I ever thought he could be. So I said, "You are a good man." And he gave me a look purely appraising and laughed and said, "You can take my word for it, Reverend. There are worse." But then he said, "What about this town? If we came here and got married, could we live here? Would people leave us alone?" Well, I didn't know the answer to that one either. I thought so. He said, "There was a fire at the Negro church." "Well, that was a little nuisance fire, and it happened many years ago." "And it has been many years since there was a Negro church." Of course, there wasn't much I could say to that. He said, "You have influence here." I said that might be true, but I couldn't promise to live long enough to make much use of it. I mentioned my heart. He said, "I had no right to weary you with my troubles," which I took to mean there had been no point in it. I thought our conversation had been good on balance, and I said that, and he nodded and said goodbye. And then after a minute he said, "No matter, Papa. I believe I've lost them anyway." I just sat there with my head on my desk and went over this in my mind and prayed until your mother came looking for me. She thought I had had some sort of episode, and I let her think that. It seemed to me as if I ought to have had one, and there was nothing I could say to her in any case. You might wonder about my pastoral discretion, writing this all out. Well, on one hand, it is the way I have of considering things. On the other hand, He is a man about whom you may never hear one good word, and I just don't know another way to let you see the beauty there is in him. That was 2 days ago. Now it's Sunday again. When you do this sort of work, it seems to be Sunday all the time. Or Saturday night. You just finish preparing for 1 week, and it's already the next week. This morning I read from one of those old sermons your mother keeps leaving around for me. It was on Romans 1. They became vain in their reasonings, and their senseless heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and so on. The Old Testament text was from Exodus, the plague of darkness. The sermon was a sort of attack on rationalism and irrationalism, the point being that both worship the creature rather than the creator. I had glanced over it a little, but as I read it, it surprised me, sometimes because it seemed right, and sometimes because it seemed embarrassingly wrong, and always because it seemed like something someone else must have written. Jack Boughton was there in that weary suit and tie sitting beside you, and you were very pleased. And I believe your mother was, too. Now, it does not at all agree with my notion of preaching to stand there reading from a stack of yellowed pages full of what I must have thought once, trying to play down the certainty I had written into the language some black night half a lifetime ago. And there in the second pew was young Boughton, who always seems to see right through me. And I, being newly persuaded that he might come into a church with some however cynical hope of encountering a living truth, was obliged to mouth these dead words while he sat there, smiling at me. I do think there was a point in associating rationalism and irrationalism, that is, materialism and idolatry. And if I had had the energy to depart from the text, I could have made something of that. As it was, I just read the sermon, shook all those hands, and came home and took a nap on the couch. I did have the feeling that young Boughton might actually have been comforted by the irrelevance of my preachments to anything that had passed between us, anything to do with him at all. God bless the poor devil. The fact was, standing there, I wished there were grounds for my old dread. That amazed me. I felt as if I'd bequeathed him my wife and child, if I could supply the loss of his own. I woke up this morning, thinking this town might as well be standing on the absolute floor of hell for all the truth there is in it, and the fault is mine as much as anyone's. I was thinking about the things that had happened here just in my lifetime. The droughts, and the influenza, and the depression, and 3 terrible wars. It seems to me now we never looked up from the trouble we had just getting by to put the obvious question, that is, to ask what it was the Lord was trying to make us understand. The word preacher comes from an old French word, prédicateur, which means prophet. And what is the purpose of a prophet except to find meaning in trouble? Well, we didn't answer the question, so the question was just taken away from us. We became like the people without the law, people who didn't know their right hand from their left, just stranded here. A stranger might ask why there is a town here at all. Our own children might ask, and who can answer them? It was just a dogged little outpost in the sandhills within striking distance of Kansas. That's really all it was meant to be. It was a place John Brown and Jim Lane could fall back on when they needed to heal and rest. There must have been 100 little towns like it, set up in the heat of an old urgency that is all forgotten now. And their littleness and their shabbiness, which was the measure of the courage and passion that went into the making of them, now just look awkward and provincial and ridiculous, even to the people who have lived here long enough to know better. It looks ridiculous to me. I truly suspect I never left because I was afraid I would not come back. I have mentioned that my father and my mother left here. Well, they certainly did. Edward bought a piece of land down on the Gulf Coast and built a cottage for his own family and for them. He did it mainly to get my mother away from this ferocious climate, and that was kind of him because her rheumatism became severe as she got older. The idea was that they would spend a year down there getting settled in, and then they would come back again to Gilead and only go south for the worst of the winter until my father retired. So I took his pulpit for that first year. And then they never did come back, except twice to visit, the first time when I lost Louisa, and the second time to talk me into leaving with them. That second time I asked my father to preach, and he shook his head and said, "I just can't do it anymore." He told me that it had not been his intention to leave me stranded here. In fact, it was his hope that I would seek out a larger life than this. He and Edward both felt strongly what excellent use I could make of a broader experience. He told me that looking back on Gilead from any distance made it seem a relic, an archaism. When I mentioned the history we had here, he laughed and said, "Old, unhappy, far-off things and battles long ago." And that irritated me. He said, "Just look at this place. Every time a tree gets to a decent size, the wind comes along and breaks it." He was expounding the wonders of the larger world, and I was resolving in my heart never to risk the experience of them. He said, "I have become aware that we here lived within the limits of notions that were very old and even very local. I want you to understand that you do not have to be loyal to them." He thought he could excuse me from my loyalty, as if it were loyalty to him, as if it were just some well-intended mistake he could correct for me, as if it were not loyalty to myself at the very least, putting the law to one side, so to speak, since I knew perfectly well at the time, as I had for years and years, that the Lord absolutely transcends any understanding I have of him, which makes loyalty to him a different thing from loyalty to whatever customs and doctrines and memories I happen to associate with him. I know that, and I knew it then. How ignorant did he think I was? I had read Owen and James and Huxley and Swedenborg, and for heaven's sake, Blavatsky, as he well knew, since he had virtually read them over my shoulder. I subscribed to The Nation. I was never Edward. But I was no fool, either, and I almost said as much. I don't recall that I actually said anything, taken aback as I was. Well, all he accomplished was to make me homesick for a place I never left. I couldn't believe he would speak to me as if I were not competent to invest my loyalties as I saw fit. How could I accept the advice of someone who had such a low estimation of me? Those were my thoughts at the time. What a day that was. Then, in a week or so, I got that letter from him. I have mentioned loneliness to you, and darkness, and I thought then I already knew what they were. But that day, it was as if a great cold wind swept over me, the like of which I had never felt before, and that wind blew for years and years. My father threw me back on myself and on the Lord. That's a fact, so I find little to regret. It cost me a great deal of sorrow, but I learned from it. Why is this on my mind, anyway? I was thinking about the frustrations and the disappointments of life, of which there are a very great many. I haven't been entirely honest with you about that. This morning I went over to the bank and cashed a check, thinking to help Jack out a little. I thought he probably needed to go to Memphis, not right away necessarily, but at some time. I went over to Boughton's and waited around, talking about nothing, wasting time I couldn't spare, till I had a chance to speak to him in private. I offered him the money, and he laughed and put it in my jacket pocket and said, "What are you doing, Papa? You don't have any money." And then his eyes chilled over the way they do, and he said, "I'm leaving. Don't worry. I took your money, your mother's money, of which there is a truly pitiful amount, and tried to give it away. And that is how it was received. I said, "Are you going to Memphis, then?" And he said, "Anywhere else." He smiled and cleared his throat and said, "I got that letter I've been waiting for." My heart was very heavy. There was Boughton, sitting in his Morris chair, staring at nothing. Glory told me the only words he had said all day were, "Jesus never had to be old." Glory is upset, and Jack is wretched, and they were making polite talk with me about nothing, probably wondering why I didn't leave, and I was wishing, to goodness, I could just go home. Then the moment came when I could do Jack the little kindness I had come for, and all I did was offend him. Then I came home, and your mother made me lie down and sent you off with Tobias. She lowered the shades. She knelt beside me and stroked my hair for a while. And after a little rest, I got up and wrote this, which I have now read over. Jack is leaving. Glory was so upset with him that she came to me to talk about it. She has sent out the alarm to the brothers and sisters that they must all desist from their humanitarian labors and come home. She believes old Boughton can't be long for this world. "How could he possibly leave now?" she says. And that's a fair question, I suppose. But I think I know the answer to it. The house will fill up with those estimable people and their husbands and wives and their pretty children. How could he be there in the midst of it all with that sad and splendid treasure in his heart? I also have a wife and child. I can tell you this, that if I'd married some rosy dame and she had given me 10 children, and they had each given me 10 grandchildren, I'd leave them all on Christmas Eve, on the coldest night of the world, and walk 1,000 miles just for the sight of your face, your mother's face. And if I never found you, my comfort would be in that hope, my lonely and singular hope, which could not exist in the whole of creation except in my heart and in the heart of the Lord. That is just a way of saying I could never thank God sufficiently for the splendor he has hidden from the world. Your mother accepted, of course, and revealed to me, in your sweetly ordinary face. Those kind Boughton brothers and sisters would be ashamed of the wealth of their lives, beside the seeming poverty of Jack's life, and he would utterly and bitterly prefer what he had lost to everything they had. That is not a tolerable state of mind to be in, as I am well aware. And old Boughton, if he could stand up out of his chair, out of his decrepitude and crankiness and sorrow and limitation, would abandon all those handsome children of his, mild and confident as they are, and follow after that one son whom he has never known, whom he has favored as one does a wound, and he would protect him as a father cannot, defend him with a strength he does not have, sustain him with a bounty beyond any resource he could ever dream of having. If Boughton could be himself, he would utterly pardon every transgression, past, present, and to come, whether or not it was a transgression in fact, or his to pardon. He would be that extravagant. That is a thing I would love to see. As I have told you, I myself was the good son, so to speak, the one who never left his father's house, even when his father did, a fact which surely puts my credentials beyond all challenge. I am one of those righteous for whom the rejoicing in heaven will be comparatively restrained. And that's all right. There is no justice in love, no proportion in it, and there need not be, because in any specific instance it is only a glimpse or parable of an embracing, incomprehensible reality. It makes no sense at all, because it is the eternal breaking in on the temporal. So how could it subordinate itself to cause or consequence? It is worth living long enough to outlast whatever sense of grievance you may acquire. Another reason why you must be careful of your health. I think I'll put an end to all this writing. I've read it over, more or less, and I've found some things of interest in it, mainly the way I have been drawn back into the world in the course of it. The expectation of death I began with reads like a kind of youthfulness, it seems to me now. The novelty of it interested me a good deal, clearly. This morning I saw Jack Boughton walking up toward the bus stop, looking too thin for his clothes, carrying a suitcase that seems to weigh almost nothing, looking a good deal past his youth, looking like someone you wouldn't much want your daughter to marry, looking somehow elegant and brave. I called to him, and he stopped and waited for me, and I walked with him up to the bus stop. I brought along The Essence of Christianity, which I had set on the table by the door, hoping I might have a chance to give it to him. He turned it over in his hands, laughing a little at how beat up it is. He said, "I remember this from forever." Maybe he was thinking it looked like the kind of thing he used to pocket in the old days. That thought crossed my mind, and it made me feel as though the book did actually belong to him. I believe he was pleased with it. I dog-eared page 20. Only that which is apart from my own being is capable of being doubted by me. How, then, can I doubt of God, who is my being? To doubt of God is to doubt of myself. And so on. I memorized that and a good bit more, so I could talk to Edward about it. But I didn't want to ruin the good time we'd had that one day, playing catch, and the occasion really never arose again. There were two further points I felt I should have made in our earlier conversations. One of them being that doctrine is not belief. It is only one way of talking about belief. And the other being that the Greek word sozo, which is usually translated saved, can also mean healed, restored, that sort of thing. So the conventional translation narrows the meaning of the word in a way that can create false expectations. I thought he should be aware that grace is not so poor a thing that it cannot present itself in any number of ways. Well, I was also making conversation. I knew he must have heard more or less the same things from his father any number of times. My first thought was that nobody ought to be as lonely as he looked to me walking along by himself. And I believe he was glad of the company. He nodded from time to time, and his expression was very polite. As we walked, he glanced around at the things you never really look at when you live in a town, the fretting on a gable, the path worn across an empty lot, a hammock slung between a cottonwood and a clothesline pole. We passed the church. He said, "I'll never see this place again." And there was a kind of sad wonder in his voice that I recognized. It gave me a turn. So I said, "You take care of yourself. They could need you sometime." After a minute, he nodded, conceding the possibility. Then he stopped and looked at me and said, "You know, I'm doing the worst possible thing again, leaving now. Glory will never forgive me. She says, 'This is it. This is your masterpiece.'" He was smiling, but there was actual fear in his eyes, a kind of amazement, and there might well have been. It was truly a dreadful thing he was doing, leaving his father to die without him. It was the kind of thing only his father would forgive him for. So I said, "Glory talked to me about all that. I told her not to judge, that there might be more to the situation. Thank you. I understand why you have to leave. I really do. That was as true a thing as I have ever said. And I will tell you, remarkable as it seemed to me, at that moment I felt grateful for all my old bitterness of heart." He cleared his throat. "Then you wouldn't mind saying goodbye to my father for me?" "I will do that. Certainly I will." I didn't know how to continue the conversation beyond that point, but I didn't want to leave him, and in any case, I had to sit down on the bench beside him on account of my heart. So there we were. I said, "If you would accept a few dollars of that money of mine, you'd be doing me a kindness." He laughed and said, I suppose I could see my way clear. So I gave him $40, and he kept 20 and gave 20 back. We sat there for a while. Then I said, "The thing I would like, actually, is to bless you." He shrugged. "What would that involve?" "Well, as I envision it, it would involve my placing my hand on your brow and asking the protection of God for you. But if it would be embarrassing..." There were a few people on the street. "No, no," he said. "That doesn't matter." And he took his hat off and set it on his knee and closed his eyes and lowered his head, almost rested it against my hand. And I did bless him to the limit of my powers, whatever they are, repeating the benediction from Numbers, of course. "The Lord make his face to shine upon thee, and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee, and give thee peace." Nothing could be more beautiful than that, or more expressive of my feelings, certainly, or more sufficient, for that matter. Then when he didn't open his eyes or lift up his head, I said, "Lord bless John Ames Boughton, this beloved son and brother and husband and father." Then he sat back and looked at me as if he were waking out of a dream. "Thank you, Reverend," he said, and his tone made me think that to him it might have seemed I had named everything I thought he no longer was, when that was absolutely the furthest thing from my meaning, the exact opposite of my meaning. Well, anyway, I told him it was an honor to bless him, and that was also absolutely true. In fact, I'd have gone through seminary and ordination and all the years intervening for that one moment. He just studied me in that way he has. Then the bus came. I said, "We all love you, you know." And he laughed and said, "You're all saints." He stopped in the door and lifted his hat, and then he was gone. God bless him. I made it as far as the church and went inside and rested there for a long time. I believe I saw in young Boughton's face as we walked along a sense of irony at having invested hope in this sad old place, and also the cost to him of relinquishing it. And I knew what hope it was. It was just that kind the place was meant to encourage, that a harmless life could be lived here unmolested. "There shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof." That is prophecy, a vision of the prophet Zechariah. He says it will be marvelous in the eyes of the people, and so it might well be to people almost anywhere in this sad world, to play catch of an evening, to smell the river, to hear the train pass. These little towns were once the bold ramparts meant to shelter just such peace. "Your mother seems to want every supper to be my favorite supper. There is often meatloaf and always dessert. She puts candles on the table, since dark is coming early now. I suspect she has brought them from the church, and that's all right. Often she wears her blue dress. You have outgrown your red shirt. Old Boughton's family have gathered, except the one his heart yearns for. They pay their respects and invite us for dinner, but these days we three love to be at home. You come in, reeking of evening air, with your eyes bright and your cheeks and fingers pink and cold, too beautiful in the candlelight for my old eyes. The cold has silenced all the insects. The dark seems to make us speak softly, like gentle conspirators. Your mother says the grace and butters your bread. I do wish Boughton could have seen how his boy received his benediction, how he bowed his head. If I told him, if he understood, he would have been jealous to have seen it, jealous to have been the one who bestowed the blessing. It is almost as if I felt his hand on my hand. Well, I can imagine him beyond the world, looking back at me with an amazement of realization. This is why we have lived this life. There are a thousand reasons to live this life, every one of them sufficient. I promised young Boughton that I would say goodbye to his father for him, so I strolled over there after dinner when I knew the old fellow would be asleep. When the room was empty, I whispered a few words. My good friend is so nearly gone from the world that the clouds have settled over his mortal understanding, and his hearing has been doubtful for years. I knew if I spoke that name to him, while he was awake, he would struggle to gather himself. He would be avid to understand, and I'd have created an eagerness in him that I could not then, could never in my life by any means placate, as if anything I could say could resolve any part of his great mystery for him. He would be alone in the confusions of his grief, and I just did not have the strength to witness that. I thought how good it would be if he could be like ancient Jacob, the cherished son who had been lost to him, bringing for his blessing the splendid young Robert Boughton Miles. I had not thought to see thy face, and lo, God hath let me see thy seed also. There was a joy in the thought of how beautiful that would have been, beautiful as any vision of angels. It seems to me that when something really ought to be true, then it has a very powerful truth, which starts me thinking again about heaven. Well, I do that much of the time, as you know. Poor Glory put a chair for me beside Boughton's bed, and I sat with him a good while. I used to crawl in through the window of that room in the dark of the morning to wake him up so we could go fishing. His mother would get cross if we woke her, too, so we were very stealthy. Sometimes he would just not want to quit sleeping, and I'd pull on his hair and tug on his ear and whisper to him, and if I thought of something ridiculous to say, sometimes he'd wake up laughing. That was so long ago. There he was yesterday evening, sleeping on his right side, as he always did, in an embrace of the Lord, I have no doubt, though I knew if I woke him up, he'd be back in Gethsemane. So I said to him in his sleep, I bless that boy of yours for you. I still feel the weight of his brow on my hand. I said, I love him as much as you meant me to. So certain of your prayers are finally answered, old fellow. And mine too. Mine too. We had to wait a long time, didn't we? When I left, I saw Glory standing in the hallway, looking in on all the quiet talk there was in the parlor, her brothers and sisters and their wives and husbands and their children, grown and half-grown, trading news and talking politics and playing hearts. There were more of them in the kitchen and more upstairs. As I was leaving, I met five or six who had been out for a walk. It shames me that I had not thought till then how hard it must have been for her to have Jack gone, and to have been left alone in that orderly turbulence of fruitfulness and contentment, left alone to tolerate all that tactful and heartfelt kindness, with no one there even to smile with her at the sheer endlessness of it, and no one there for her to defend, which is the worst kind of abandonment. Only the Lord Himself can comfort that. It has seemed to me sometimes as though the Lord breathes on this poor gray ember of creation, and it turns to radiance for a moment or a year or the span of a life, and then it sinks back into itself again, and to look at it no one would know it had anything to do with fire or light. That is what I said in the Pentecost sermon. I have reflected on that sermon, and there is some truth in it. But the Lord is more constant and far more extravagant than it seems to imply. Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except a little willingness to see. Only who could have the courage to see it? I'll just ask your mother to have those old sermons of mine burned. The deacons could arrange it. There are enough to make a good fire. I'm thinking here of hot dogs and marshmallows, something to celebrate the first snow. Of course, she can set by any of them she might want to keep, but I don't want her to waste much effort on them. They mattered or they didn't, and that's the end of it. There are two occasions when the sacred beauty of creation becomes dazzlingly apparent, and they occur together. One is when we feel our mortal insufficiency to the world, and the other is when we feel the world's mortal insufficiency to us. Augustine says the Lord loves each of us as an only child, and that has to be true. He will wipe the tears from all faces. It takes nothing from the loveliness of the verse to say that is exactly what will be required. Theologians talk about the prevenient grace that precedes grace itself and allows us to accept it. I think there must also be a prevenient courage that allows us to be brave, that is, to acknowledge that there is more beauty than our eyes can bear, that precious things have been put into our hands, and to do nothing to honor them is to do great harm. And therefore, this courage allows us, as the old men said, to make ourselves useful. It allows us to be generous, which is another way of saying exactly the same thing. But that is the pulpit speaking. What have I to leave you but the ruins of old courage and the lore of old gallantry and hope? Well, as I have said, it is all an ember now, and the good Lord will surely some day breathe it into flame again. I love the prairie. So often I have seen the dawn come and the light flood over the land, and everything turn radiant at once. That word, good, so profoundly affirmed in my soul, that I am amazed I should be allowed to witness such a thing. There may have been a more wonderful first moment, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. But for all I know to the contrary, they still do sing and shout, and they certainly might well. Here on the prairie, there is nothing to distract attention from the evening and the morning, nothing on the horizon to abbreviate or to delay. Mountains would seem an impertinence from that point of view. To me, it seems rather Christ-like to be as unadorned as this place is, as little regarded. I can't help imagining that you will leave sooner or later, and it's fine if you have done that, or you mean to do it. This whole town does look like whatever hope becomes after it begins to weary a little, then weary a little more. But hope deferred is still hope. I love this town. I think sometimes of going into the ground here as a last wild gesture of love. I, too, will smolder away the time until the great and general incandescence. I pray that you grow up a brave man in a brave country. I will pray that you find a way to be useful. I'll pray, and then I'll sleep.
We hope you've enjoyed Gilead, an Audio Renaissance audiobook from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Text copyright 2004 by Marilyn Robinson. Production copyright 2005 by BBC Audiobooks America. Published by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible Kids hopes you have enjoyed this audiobook. For more like it, check out kids.audible.com.